Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. What's the connection between liking music and the people who make it? Trying to convince landowners to allow public hunting and fishing on their property, and supervising game wardens. Mike Korn is the connection. He's just retired after nearly 30 years with Montana's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Mike, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in the San Fernando Valley of California, back when there were still a lot of orange groves around there. I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s.
In the countryside or in town?
It was in town. Van Nuys.
What'd your folks do?
My mom was a homemaker and then later got involved in politics, ran a couple political campaigns, very active in farm worker,
United
Farm Worker stuff. And then also a couple of candidates who were running for assembly. My dad was a college professor at a junior college there in Van Nuys, Valley Junior College, and also taught at UCLA.
What did he teach?
Anthropology was his main thing. He was a published author in physical anthropology, did a couple of textbooks.
Let me ask you, because I'm not sure that I know the difference. Physical anthropology would be the evolution of people, human beings, in terms of the physicality of the form of the species?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay, and cultural is the story of different
cultures, different people's ethnicities, if you want. That might be a way to couch it, whether it's Amazonian tribespeople or longshoremen in San Francisco. There was a great book on that. Or
Montanans.
Or various groups in Montana.
Growing up, looking back, let's say you're entering high school, what are your key values that still stick with you?
I like people.
Okay, where'd that come from?
I think my folks. And also, the neighborhood I grew in was kind of a changing neighborhood in the valley. It had a lot of different kinds of people. We had Hispanics there. There's a few black people, Japanese-American, Nisei and Sansei, Koreans, and we had a neat neighborhood.
I was in California in the 60s, grew up there in the 50s. The Farm Workers Union, led by Cesar Chavez, was very controversial. Did that controversy affect your values or thinking as a growing up in that period of time?
Yeah, to a degree. My dad was an old union guy, teacher's union. He was blacklisted in the 50s for activities that he did in the teacher's union. And so my family always had an affinity for unions. And so my mom's involvement, and it wasn't, you know, in the fields, but it was certainly raising money, and the grape boycott was going on then.
Right.
And so she was involved in that. And
just for our listeners, there was a big boycott of non-union grapes by liberal left interests around the country.
Right.
Where'd you go to college?
A couple of places. I went to San Francisco State. At the time, it had just become Cal State San Francisco.
Which, when you entered when?
Fall of 71.
Okay.
Right after the riots that were there. There were some big riots that took place there, anti-war riots.
How long were you there?
One semester.
That's pretty quick. What happened?
I dropped out and moved back east to Tennessee, to a little town called Mountain City, Tennessee, with dreams of chasing people around with a tape recorder and recording traditional Appalachian folk music like John Lomax did.
So you were interested in music?
Very much so, yeah.
And where'd that come from?
My family. My family grew up, you know, was part of the folk boom, so there was traditional music and folk music. A lot of my dad's associates at UCLA and at the college he was at, there was, you know, Lead Belly being played at the family household.
Okay, so you're a college kid, drop out, go to Tennessee. In summary, what happens?
I spent 4 months basically immersing myself in Appalachian culture, learning a whole bunch about it, meeting some very interesting people, making some recordings. And that fall, I returned back to L.A. and started classes in the Anthro Department at Cal State Northridge.
Anthro Department.
Anthropology.
Okay.
And under a teacher there named Bess Lomax Hawes.
Did this decision last, and why did you make it?
It definitely lasted, and still does.
All right. Why did it interest you, and why did you make that decision?
I guess growing up in the household I did, it was kind of an analytical household. And the music, the traditional music appealed to me, but also learning more about it and the cultures that that music came from, whether it was Appalachian, Southern Appalachian music, there was traditional Mexican music in the neighborhood I grew up in.
But a lot of people hear music. We all hear music of different sorts. And in that era, let's say folk music, it was a politically active era, so there was political music. I'm thinking of Bob Dylan or Peter, Paul, and Mary. But people don't decide to take up cultural anthropology as a result in part of the diverse music. What was it about you? You said you liked people.
I enjoyed different kinds of people. I came from a musical household.
Okay.
There was a lot of music. My dad played violin. My mom was in the Hollywood Baby Orchestra when she was a little girl. So it all came together, and this was kind of an academic way of pursuing this. And in meeting Bess Hawes, she was teaching in Northridge, and she encouraged me when I showed her, played these tapes that were similar to the stuff that her brother Alan had collected in the Southern Appalachians, or her father John had collected back in the 20s, and that sort of time. It all kind of came together.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Mike Korn, who has just retired as Deputy Chief of Law Enforcement for Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So you're studying cultural anthropology, and music remains a major component of that, correct?
Correct.
You get a degree. What did you learn that you didn't know before?
Well, it gave me the opportunity to thoroughly study it and also work with people who are ethnomusicologists, that sort of thing. And also through my work, I got part-time work with the Smithsonian Institution with the Festival of American Folklife, where they go around and bring people from different parts of the country to perform at this mega folk festival on the National Mall in Washington, D.C.
When was that?
I worked for them from 74 through 78, including 1976 when they had this big bicentennial bash on the National Mall.
What did you learn from that experience as an undergraduate, and let's say throw in the Smithsonian experience, which is highly unusual, that you didn't know going in? How is Mike Korn a different guy coming out of college than he is going in?
Give me a whole bunch of different skills in terms of interviewing people and also analyzing how things like music are an expression of culture, how it's a natural and implicit expression of culture.
What do you mean? A natural and implicit expression of culture. Give me an example of what we're talking about.
Well, probably for that period of time, it was traditional music and old-time fiddle music in particular, how people coming out, who were coming out of Oklahoma to California, brought their music with them. And it was a very important part of their cultural expression and their social expression in their lives. That life in Oklahoma with those old-time fiddle tunes there in Long Beach, California, when they were working over on the Signal Hill drilling for oil.
Graduate school?
Yeah, 77 to 79, Western Kentucky University, in basically cultural anthropology.
And if during that graduate school period I had said, what do you plan to do, young man, what would you have said?
Become a public folklorist. Because at that time there was a great deal of support at the national level and the state level for people doing cultural research at a state level throughout the whole United States, and particularly doing that kind of work in the West, which previously had been viewed as pretty much unplowed ground.
Let me just ask you, a cultural folklorist, and we had a lot of ground to cover here, but in a nutshell, does it record the traditions of different parts of the United States and put them in some sort of archive so we can kind of figure out where we've been?
Exactly.
So you're back east in graduate school, want to be a folklorist. How do you end up in Montana?
At the time, there were a number of programs going on through the National Endowment for the Arts to do this kind of research at a state level and archive the stuff, basically state identity, I guess you could say. And a position was offered here in Montana. I'd always had an affinity for Montana. I had relatives from up in northeast Montana who were railroad people. And so when the opportunity arose, I applied for it, and I was hired on.
In what year?
1979.
Been here ever since?
Mm-hmm.
And that job officially is?
It was director of the Montana Folklife Project.
What does that mean in nuts and bolts that I can understand?
Basically, we were collecting traditional culture and by photograph, by video, by tape recording of traditional cultures in the state of Montana. A lot of people think Montana is just a western state, but it's made up of a ton of different cultures.
For example, what are we talking about? Native American people?
Absolutely that. I mean, that's probably the most striking example of things. But you have people in Anaconda who are Serbs. You have folks who came to Montana to work the mines in Butte. You have ranching culture. You have forestry culture, Packers and Hutterites. I mean, it's far bigger than most people from the outside think. I think we take it for granted.
How in your job did you record this diverse culture?
Went out with cameras. We went out with tape recorders, video recording equipment, any kind of way we could document things. There were a group of people that worked with me on contract in different parts of the state. Did that work. We had to go out and make the contacts in these communities.
Would they let you in? Would they welcome you, or were they suspicious?
It took some time. In some
Tell
places,
me about it.
Some places it was pretty easy, especially if myself or someone who had some knowledge of the tradition or the people in that community already went in. People who went in cold, it took a while. People, you know, well, what do you want exactly? What's this all about?
Let me just be clear now. You are supervising this. Does that mean you've got a desk job or you're also out in the field?
I was doing desk work, but I was definitely out in the field and out there talking to people myself, recording them, meeting people. I mean, I was all over the state of Montana, and talk about a great job. I got to see all of Montana, and that's something a lot of people who are born and raised here don't get to do. It was wonderful.
Yeah, it's a big state. In that experience, which is highly unusual, anything surprise you looking back or surprise you at the time?
How, once you made the first contact, how easy people were to talk to. Once they understood what you wanted and that you were interested in them, very forthcoming.
And that's across these diverse cultural groups?
Generally speaking, there were some times when things were difficult with Native people, mm-hmm. because they have a long history of people coming in with cameras and tape recorders and basically stealing their culture.
Okay.
And
but other than that, generally speaking, people receptive if they decide at some entry level they trust you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if you were to summarize that initial interaction, which clearly is important, it's a door opener or a door closer. What was the key to getting them to open the door?
Meeting them on their own terms.
Meaning what?
Means knowing something about that cultural community or that community in general before you go in there, and not just kind of going and asking just dumb questions, but having some background, saying, I know old Joe over in Kalispell, and he said for me to talk to you about this because you knew about that. I mean, typical Montana things. The old one small town with a long main street kind of stuff.
With an experience that by definition involves diversity, different kinds of people, specific individuals, unique individuals, what were you left with when you got through with the process?
A real strong sense of what makes up this state, a real strong sense of the different parts of Montana, and how they're really distinct, how southwest Montana around Dillon and the Big Hole in that country, the ranch culture there is really unique, and the railroad culture that came up from the UP that stopped in Dillon, as opposed to up on the High Line where you have all Well, the Honyockers and the folks in the dry land farms and the ranchers up there, or certainly the distinctions between the native peoples and the Indian nations in this state. People don't appreciate those distinctions. But also in terms of working Montanans, the work Montanans do across the state that's so different, whether it's railroaders, miners, loggers, all the classic ones, saddle makers. I mean, there's all this stuff here, and it was great.
With all that diversity, historical and human, we still have, quote, Montana. Now, is it just a geographic boundary, or were you left with something that it is more than just a geographic boundary of very diverse people?
It's a community from border to border. Yeah, we have the borders on it, but it's interesting how many different people cross different areas of familiarity, whether it's they know somebody through kids' sports, or the guy's a rancher in the Big Hole, and he knows a rancher over in Rosebud Creek. But all the people in Montana have so many different ways that they cross each other's paths.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Mike Korn, who has just retired as Deputy Chief of Law Enforcement for the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So how do you go from this folklorist work to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks? That seems quite a leap.
Not at all. George Bird Grinnell did it, the man who was partially responsible for a lot of stuff in Glacier Park. He was a great naturalist, but he was also an ethnographer of the Blackfeet. He wrote books on the Blackfeet Indians.
I didn't know that, or I just forgot it.
Cultural and natural conservation walk hand in hand in my mind. And it was not a big leap. I hunted and fished like most everybody in Montana, love the outdoors, one of the reasons I love living here. And to be able to make that my work was even better. So when the position of Landowner-Sportsman Relations Coordinator opened up with the department, I applied for that, and I was given it.
What year we're talking?
1989.
Okay, Landowner-Sportsman Relations, what's that job do?
Basically, it's trying to work with private landowners. Two-thirds of Montana is private land, unlike other western states. So when it comes to wildlife, when it comes to recreation, when it comes to a lot of things, private land is a big, big player in it. And specifically in wildlife management and in outdoor recreation, it's a main consideration. So working with private landowners is absolutely critical in Montana.
Okay, now let's just make clear a couple of fundamentals. Two-thirds of the land is privately owned. The wildlife is publicly owned.
Correct.
So in one fundamental sense, you have the potential for ongoing different perspectives and tension. And if you follow Montana politics, there's a lot of tension around private lands, public wildlife, elk eating, haystacks, etc. Fair?
Supposedly private property rights versus the public trust.
So your job is sort of a reflection of the department's awareness or the legislature's awareness that there's a nexus there and we got to be working in that arena.
Yep.
How long did you hold that job?
I held that job from 1989 till 1996.
Okay, fair piece of time. Tell me about it.
The big thing was working on what they call block management, which is a public access project on private land.
Landowners are paid a fee to allow access. I mean, there's some parsing in this, I know, but to deal with the effects of access, so they're not supposedly paying for access, something like that. A lot of acres enrolled in block management, voluntary program.
When I was in it, the payments were for things like putting in a cattle guard or putting up signs or hiring somebody to take permission slips on behalf of a landowner.
Okay.
It was very simple. It was really informal, and it started out, I'd say we had a few hundred thousand acres in the program of private land, which you get into eastern Montana, that's not a hard thing to do.
And now it's up in the
millions.
Millions of acres.
Okay. Absolutely.
So you were basically at the ground floor of block management?
Mm-hmm. And it went up from there in 1995 is when the legislature came up and set up the formal thing to compensate people for the impacts on private land and all the things we see today in terms of the program. And from at that point, you know, in 1995, the program changed. The legislature was involved. The Private Lands Public Wildlife Council came in, and they set up a very formal system for block management. But all of this stuff was based on our field people doing one-on-one relationships with these private landowners.
That's what I wanted to get to. In other words, it sounds like your experience as a folklorist would have been useful in reaching across that boundary between I'm fish, wildlife, and parks on the one hand, I'm a rancher on the other, there's some history of distrust or whatever. Fair?
Yes. It was a big advantage because I'd worked with a lot of people in the ranching community in the course of my folklore work, and I showed up at the door wearing a gray uniform, and they kind of went, "What? You're what?" And I started talking, and although I wasn't in that position doing a lot of these individual things myself on the ground, that's up to our field folks. Okay. I did a good number of them, and I made a point of going out and meeting with people who I knew in that other context and said, "You knew me then, now here's what I'm doing now, and can I interest you in something like this?" And it was a great thing because when I was doing the folklore work, I got a real good understanding not only of what ranching is about, but a lot of the attitudes that go with it and what things might work and what things might not and what things shouldn't work.
We're talking about what I will call a traditional conservative community where new ideas are looked at least skeptically, maybe more. You just said some things work, some things don't. Give me some examples specifically.
I think the big thing that would come up is dealing with hunters on private land. There's a lot of problems involved with that.
And, so I've heard.
And not just the obvious, "I'm sorry, Mr. Rancher, I shot your cow" kind of things, but just in terms of the logistics when people are on someone's private property, mm-hmm, and putting up with them and making sure that things work. And what we offered through sitting down with a rancher or just a landowner is ways like, you know, getting people in there to offer permission slips or just some way of managing the hunters on the private land. Just north of here, the Sieben Ranch is a great example because they had problems with vandalism on the ranch. They had problems with people driving off the road. And we got together with John and Ina Bacchus, the local wardens did, and said, what is it you need? Hmm. And a lot of people use that ranch for hunting and all kinds of recreation. And it went from being a place where there were a lot of problems with that to a place where there were almost none, primarily by setting up a road management system up there of designated roads where these are where you drive and these are places you don't, enforcing it. When people didn't do that, they were cited for it. And also to the point where the local community here has such a proprietary interest in keeping that huge, huge area open for public hunting, that when things started to go wrong, we'd hear about it, and we'd hear about it fast.
So how does that develop? What are the key ingredients to developing that kind of collaborative relationship where you're talking about somebody's property? It's pretty personal.
Absolutely.
What are the keys to success?
Taking the time. I tell our wardens, you're driving down the road and you see that rancher working in the field or working on his hanging equipment there, do you take the time, you turn left at his gate, and you go in and say hi, and just talk to him. Get a sense of what's going on, because our people, our field people, are part of that community. And the way you're going to find out what the needs are of that private landowner to get that public hunting in there, to allow access, is not by some big meeting where there are 60 people. It's sitting there talking with them, knowing what their issues are, knowing what the problems are there, and working things through. But it works.
Just to be clear, when did you transfer from landowner-sportsman relations to supervising game wardens?
In 1996, I became Helena Area Coordinator, basically supervised an area based out of Helena here. And then in 2006, I became Deputy Chief of Law Enforcement.
It sounds to me like you're saying that your whole experience going back to the folklorist stuff back in Tennessee to your Montana project and then dealing with ranchers has a strong thread through it of the necessity
of knowing how to constructively interact with individual people across cultural lines.
Fair. It's all in relationships.
I think of law enforcement people as being trained in law enforcement academies as how to arrest people and to read them their rights and to, you know how to use appropriate force and not, etc. Are our game wardens trained in this sort of human interaction?
That's a good portion of their job. And what makes being a game warden unique is that, yes, you're a law enforcement officer, you're a sworn officer, but a huge amount of your work is interacting with private landowners, with citizens, with hunters, with anglers, with parks users, and not just in a law enforcement capacity. It's answering questions, working on access projects with private landowners and rod and gun clubs, things like that. So it's having all the police skills and a whole other toolbox to go along with it.
My experience with law enforcement generally is that there's pride, almost military pride, and that often does not include an awareness of the centrality of human communication. How broadly is this skill set common in the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks wardens, in your professional opinion?
I think it's pretty broad.
Why?
We hire for that. Our hiring process is one where we look for people with those kinds of skills. Yes, they have to have the kind of conventional ABC kind of skills and the physical skills, but we look for people who we see can connect with people. We hire people to live in the communities they're going to be assigned to. Used to be that our wardens were sent to eastern Montana, boom, right out of the chute, and everybody went, all right, I do my time in the gulags, and then I get a good assignment. We recruit people who want to live in East Montana, who are maybe from a ranch family, who have an affinity for that kind of a life there, that will fit, that understand it. I'm real proud of the degree that we really search for people who have people skills as well as physical skills.
One's professional work is a big part of one's life. You've been working for 36 years, you're retiring now. How do you feel about it and why?
I feel real good about it. I feel I've been absolutely privileged to do the kind of work I have. Most people live, what's the saying? Most people live lives of quiet desperation. I've been able to do the things I want to do and have a really good time doing it and build some really great relationships, because a person's career is not a checklist of accomplishments. I think it's a checklist of relationships and things that you've accomplished using those relationships.
Mike Korn, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.